This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. His critically acclaimed films include Faces and A Woman Under the Influence. Yes, today on the Afternoon Magazine, we're going to take a look at the life and work of actor and filmmaker John Cassavetes. Our guest is biographer and film and television critic Marshall Fine. Marshall Fine is the author of a new biography of Cassavetes, Accidental Genius, How John Cassavetes Invented the American Independent Film. Fine says in Accidental Genius that the word accident implies Cassavetes lucked into his career, but Fine quickly adds nothing could be further from the truth. He says, quote, Cassavetes was a talented actor with the intensity of an acetylene torch, even in the most mundane of roles. And he was an artist as a filmmaker, uncompromising in the vision that created a body of work for its subject matter and approach. We'll talk more about Cassavetes' gifts, his drive, and his approach to life in this hour of the program. Listeners, I hope you'll join the discussion with your questions and comments for our guest, Marshall Fine. Join us with a telephone call, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you're listening outside the local dialing area, call us toll-free. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about Marshall Fine. He is the incoming chairman of the New York Film Critics Circle, and he is the television and film critic for Star Magazine. His work has appeared in many other publications, including the Los Angeles Times and Playboy. He is the author now of three books, including biographies of Sam Peckinpah and Harvey Keitel. His latest book, Accidental Genius, is published by Miramax Books. Again, the phone numbers, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Marshall Fine, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thanks for having me on, Celeste.
My pleasure. You say John Cassavetes had a genius for accidents. What do you mean?
He had a way of taking things that were unexpected, that surprised him, and turning them into something else. I mean, his very first film, Shadows, grew out of some improvisations that he was doing in a theater workshop. He happened to go on a radio show that night in New York, the Gene Shepherd Show, and said, you know, we're doing these improvisations. They're about race, and this is the kind of thing that people should be making movies about, and if people would send me money, maybe we could make a movie about it. And to his surprise, the next day he started, people dropped off dollar bills and $5 bills and mailed him this cash, you know, in small denominations until he had about $2,000. And he said to the actors, well, I guess we have to make this movie because I don't know how to return this money.
Yeah.
And so he really ended up making the movie by accident, and it launched his directing career.
Yeah, and you know, the year was what, 1956?
Yeah, when he first started with this, yeah. I think the film finally came out in about 1959.
Yeah, okay. And that subject matter would have been pretty out there, don't you think, at the time?
Well, this was pre-civil rights movement. It was just shortly after Brown versus the Board of Education. He was, but he was doing improvisations using white and black actors, sort of exploring the idea of mixed race at a time before that term had even been coined. Nobody was making movies about these subjects, and yet here he thought, well, why not? And yet the word race is never even mentioned in the film. It's obviously a film about race and its effect on these people at a time when this was not part of the national discussion.
Mm. How does that film stand up today?
It holds up pretty well. I mean, if you watch it, it's obviously sort of amateurish. One of the key things about it is the title card at the end that says, what you've seen was an improvisation, and you can feel that in part, although, again, that's part of the Cassavetes myth. He left that there even though he shot the first version of it all improvisation, and then wasn't happy with how it turned out, so went back and wrote a script and reshot about two-thirds of it. But it's a testament to his directing that it looks like it's improvised.
Yeah. Well, that film made a big impression on Martin Scorsese, didn't it?
Yeah, Martin Scorsese was a film student who had an idea of making movies, but he was just a kid who thought, you know, I'll never be able to do this, and all of a sudden here is John Cassavetes making a movie with 16mm cameras and actually getting it released in Europe and in the United States and about subjects that nobody was making movies about. And he thought, well, gee, maybe I can make a movie too.
Yeah. Improvisation was important to Cassavetes, but so too the art and craft of film. Talk with us about that.
Well, he always had this reputation as being an improviser, and in fact, every film that he made was completely scripted and very well written, I always thought. But he would work on the film, he'd get the actors together to rehearse, and if something wasn't going well, he always assumed it was because of the script. And so he would let the actors improvise a little and change the words around, and once they had, then they would again put it into script form, and that would be what they would shoot. So he was, when you say he was interested in the craft, he was really more interested in the craft of acting. He wanted the actors to have the freedom to explore the characters in every facet. And if that meant that they walked out of focus, if that meant that they walked out of the lights, well, so be it. He told the cameraman, you follow the actors. The actors aren't going to follow you.
Mm. When he was starting out as a young actor, he didn't want much in the way of direction. What did he expect at that point in his career from directors, and did that change over time?
I don't think it ever did change over time. What he wanted was the freedom to create the character. He didn't want anybody to tell him who the character should be. He thought, and he told this to his actors, that, you know, all right, here's the script. The script has these characters in it, but now the character belongs to you, and it's up to you to determine who this character is and what this character feels and how he reacts in any particular given moment. And he obviously, early in his career, working in television, working in Hollywood in the 50s, you know, this was not the norm. The director was the dictator on the set, and that was one of the things that sort of turned him off of acting was, he didn't like being told how to play a character. He didn't like the fact that he had to hit his mark to be, you know, so that he was in focus, that he was in the lights, because it took his mind off of the character and being in the moment. He wanted to just be free to be in the moment as the character and explore it that way. And that was what he always insisted that his actors do.
Yeah. How did he see himself in the role of the director then?
Mostly as kind of a traffic cop. He said, you know, he really would always denigrate his own talents and say, you know, I don't know anything about directing. I don't know why they call me a director. He thought himself more as a writer who got actors together and kind of pointed the camera at them and let them go.
So he was interested in keeping things running and keeping things in continuity and so on and so forth.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, he was always interested in the moment, and he was willing to, and he wanted to go further each time, wanted to find the honesty of the particular moment, and if he didn't find it in a particular take, he'd shoot another one, and he would shoot it over and over until he pushed the actors to, you know, make them angry, whatever, till they started to kind of came out of themselves and stuck with the character and did something new and unexpected. And, I mean, again, he was always looking for that accidental moment that suddenly illuminated the scene.
Where do you think his love for spontaneity, his desire to shake things up came from?
I think that was just part of his personality. He was someone who just loved surprises, loved shaking things up. He was someone who just loved to get a response out of people, no matter what it took. I mean, I had people who went to college with him tell me stories about how he would, you know, they went out to a bar one night, and he said, well, you know, I think I'm going to try it. And they said, well, what do you mean? And he said, water. I'm allergic to water. I'm not allowed to drink it. And they said, oh, come on, you're crazy. And he says, no, it's the truth. And he went up to the bar and ordered a glass of water and kind of studied it for a moment and then took a sip and then exploded, began flailing about, throwing himself on the floor, knocking chairs and tables over. And people gathered around him, just couldn't believe, you know, couldn't understand what was going on. And once he had them all sort of with this look on their face, like, what's going on? Then he burst out laughing because he'd been putting them all on.
Yeah. Well, there's another story you tell about him at the outset of the book that's maybe not quite as funny. It's a little spooky. And that is a story that you tell about Cassavetes and a friend of his, I think it's Burton Lane, in an automat in New York.
Well, yeah, he would... He loved to provoke people, and he essentially was creating scenes and acting without sort of letting them know that they were in a scene. And so he and Burton Lane, who was a friend of his, who he created this acting workshop with, and had gone to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts with. They went to the Automat across the street from the Academy, which was in Carnegie Hall at the time, and they were sitting there, and a bodybuilder sat down at a nearby table. I mean, this was a guy who was big and muscular, and John was a little guy. I mean, he was about 5'7", although he always claimed to be 5'9". And as they were sitting there, he starts talking in a loud voice to Burton Lane about You know, he couldn't understand why anybody would go into bodybuilding. That it seemed like this really narcissistic thing, and how stupid did you have to be to spend all of your time lifting weights and looking in mirrors, and what kind of idiot would do something like this? And then, without ever directly speaking to the guy knew exactly who he was talking to and got up and, you know, angrily came over to the table. And before he could do anything, John said, "That's right, go ahead, solve this with violence." And it stopped the guy dead in his tracks long enough for John to say, "Come on, Bert, let's go." And they walked out. And Bert and Lane said later, "You know, don't ever do that again. I don't want to play these games." But to John, that was the fun of it, was seeing how far he could push a moment and act in that moment without other people realizing that he was acting.
Oh. Would you give us a sense of the stories and the characters that interested him as an actor and as a director?
He was interested in human beings. He was interested in the people that the movies tended to ignore. I mean, you look at a movie like Faces, which came out in 1968. I mean, this is 1968. It's the height of the counterculture, just after the Summer of Love, free love, hippies. Everybody's looking to sort of explode societal norms. And here's John, comes and makes a movie about upper middle class people who are, you know, being made fun of by the counterculture, and about marriage and divorce in a way that really was very supportive of marriage, even as it was showing this marriage kind of disintegrating. He was always interested in sort of people at their most human, people, again, that the movies tend to shy away from. Movies tend to catch people sort of at their apex or at their nadir. And he wanted just people who were in their lives and sort of the things that they dealt with on a day-to-day basis in a way that Hollywood always tended to ignore.
Yeah, and that's why he had to make Woman Under the Influence his own, on his own, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, this was a story about a middle-class couple, working-class couple. The wife is very emotionally needy, a little bit unhinged, and eventually the husband has to commit her to a mental institution. And then resume the marriage when she comes back out. And, you know, without murders or without, anything particularly flamboyant in terms of, love affairs or other people involved, it was just this one family going through a crisis. And again, this was, you know, the early 70s, at the point where people like Scorsese and Robert Altman were getting their start. And here was John, probably the most independent of these filmmakers, and he couldn't find anybody to finance his film. And so he wound up paying for half of it himself. I think he mortgaged his house at that point, and he convinced Peter Falk, who was notoriously stingy, to put up the other half of the money for the film.
Yeah, the money was always such a problem.
Well,
he kept at it.
Yeah, well, that, I mean, to me, that's what makes him such an independent figure, is that he was convinced that these were stories that had to be told. He had a passion for these stories, and if it meant that he had to put up his own money, well, that's what he did. I mean, it's sort of a truism in Hollywood that you never put up your own money for the movie. But John routinely did, because no one else would. And he did it because he believed in it, and he did it because he had a career as an actor, and so he was able to, he was always able to go back to work and make enough money to pay off his house, and so did his wife, Jenna Rollins. I mean, they were both working actors through all of this and would take other jobs in order to keep themselves afloat. But still, I mean, it showed an incredible commitment to his own work, that he was willing to put up his own money.
Yeah, and while he was working as an actor in order to pay for a movie, he was also working on the movie that he was making.
Well, yeah, I mean, he shot Faces in the space of about 6 months in 1965, and it didn't come out until 68, and during that time, while he was editing and doing some reshooting, I mean, he shot The Dirty Dozen, the only movie he was ever nominated for an Oscar as an actor for. He shot Rosemary's Baby. He shot Machine Gun McCain, this Italian gangster movie. He was always working in order to support his family, because the films weren't paying for it.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned his role in The Dirty Dozen as Victor Franco, and that was one of his most acclaimed roles as an actor in Robert Aldrich's film, The Dirty Dozen. And, you know, it's interesting, Aldrich also had a reputation as an independent, right?
Well, yeah, and he was a kind of a gruff, old school guy, but he and John really got along because he gave them freedom. He almost ran it like an army camp and kept asking for volunteers. And John was, you know, always ready to jump in and said, "I'll do that." And had a great time. He loved working with Robert Aldrich. He always would mention him as one of his favorite, one of the favorite directors he'd ever worked for.
Yeah. Now, not quite so favorite, Roman Polanski.
Oh, the two of them butted heads from the beginning. And, I mean, John was not a prude, but he didn't really like explicit violence or nudity in movies. And again, this is the late 60s, the early 70s, when this, because of the invention of the rating system, there's actually more freedom to do these things. And he just didn't feel that was necessary in a movie. And of course, Rosemary's Baby has quite a bit of both. And so he and Polanski butted heads. Plus, Polanski didn't really sort of see the value of the films that Cassavetes had directed. And Cassavetes didn't like being told what to do. I mean, they would do multiple takes, but it was always so that he would do exactly what Polanski had asked him to. And they, you know, just never quite wanted to, always wanted to slightly change it or, you know, take inspiration from the moment. And Polanski had a vision of what he wanted and wanted John to do it exactly as he told him.
Mm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, biographer and critic Marshall Fine, his latest book, Accidental Genius, How John Cassavetes Invented the American Independent Film. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener now, a listener in Urbana, caller on line one. Hi.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Yeah. Your book is long overdue because I knew of the actor John Cassavetes before I knew the director John Cassavetes. I was pretty young when I saw. I was like 15 in 1965. I began to be able to see his other films, the films he had made, and I was amazed at just how ingenious they were and how personal they were. And I always thought his wife was one of the, it's probably still is one of the great actresses of all times. But I'm really looking forward to your book. But I sort of think of Cassavetes as an, now that I think about back on his work and if you're talking about him, as sort of like a guy who is in the always on the periphery, but willing to step in, make some money, then leave and come and go out and do what he wanted to do. And I think of John Sayles now as like that. And I'm wondering if you had a comment on that.
Well, I think you can draw a direct line from Cassavetes through John Sayles to today's independent filmmakers. I mean, you look at the Oscars this year, and four out of the five nominees for Best Picture were independent films. So, yeah. I mean, independent film has come into the mainstream. But yeah, I mean, John Sayles has that same maverick streak that he wants to make his movies his way, and so he raises the money and he writes them, he edits them, he directs them, and he was inspired by Cassavetes in that respect.
Yeah, I think Cassavetes was a great inspiration to a lot of people. A lot of people in that business, I don't think, like to admit that, but I mean, he really is. If you look back at the body of his work, like you were talking about, it's just amazing what he has done. I mean, it's just an considering the financial drain on to do stuff like that, even if you can get people to work for nothing and that kind of thing. But I'm really looking forward to your book. I've really admired Cassavetes' work for years, and I've always wanted to know more about him. Thanks.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Other calls are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You mentioned the Academy Awards. We've just come through the awards season for films screened in 2005. What do you think of the movies that were lauded this year?
I have to say I was shocked when Crash won Best Picture because, I mean, to my way of thinking, it was not one of the five best movies of the year, let alone the best movie of the year. And I really felt that it said something about Hollywood that they just were not willing to step up and give that award to Brokeback Mountain, which, to my thinking, was the best movie of the year. Otherwise, I felt like most of the movies that were nominated were the best films of the year. Capote, Good Night and Good Luck, films like that. I thought were representative of the best work being done, and tellingly, they came from the independent world.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to when John Cassavetes was making films on his own independently. How radical was it back then to move away from Hollywood and make the kinds of films he made?
Oh, people thought he was crazy. People thought he was nuts to make movies with his own money. They didn't understand what he was doing. Plus, he ran into problems because he was working outside of the studio system. He was making non-union productions. He actually had to go before a tribunal of the Screen Actors Guild at the time when Charlton Heston was the head of it to defend himself against charges that, you know, that they wanted to fine him for making a non-union film. And he said, well, you know, I'd fine me too. Go ahead. Charlton Heston later wrote in his diary that, you know, he thought John Cassavetes deserved a little elbow room to do something different. But, I mean, it had its impact in terms of nobody expected Faces to be nominated for any Oscars because the studios had such a hold on the Academy, and yet it was nominated for Best Screenplay, for Best Supporting Actor, and Best Supporting Actress.
Mm. The actor and the director, Mark Rydell, said of Cassavetes that he could have been a huge movie star, but that wasn't enough. What sent Cassavetes into the direction of becoming a filmmaker?
Well, I think it was boredom with acting. Not so much with acting as with the way movies were made and the way TV was made. I mean, he had a passion for it. Again, it was an accident that he became an actor. He had dropped out of college, bummed around a little bit, and then ran into some friends of his who said, hey, we're going down to this acting school. It's a great place to meet girls. And he signed up at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts and really sort of found his calling there, at least for a while. Loved acting, loved the attention that it gave him, and got a break into live television and became one of the hottest actors in the live television era of the mid-1950s and used that as a springboard to make movies. But felt stifled by it, felt frustrated by the fact that they did require him to, you know, to hit his mark, to do what the director told him to do. And so he wanted to create a new paradigm, if you will, of a way for actors to work that didn't depend on a director telling them what to do, but rather that allowed them to call on their own resources.
Mm. What was his first big break?
He was in an old show called Omnibus, in a little drama that was written by Bud Schulberg, who had written On the Waterfront and What Makes Sammy Run, called Paso Doble, in which he played a disgraced bullfighter whose father was a famous bullfighter, but he was trying to follow in his father's footsteps, but just didn't have the nerve and really, you know, didn't have the constitution to be a matador, and yet, you know, was being forced to do this by the expectation of his family.
Mm. Go ahead.
Well, and he almost didn't get the part because he had been on an omnibus production a few weeks earlier and so enraged the producer at his insistence on giving the director his own thoughts and his own opinions instead of just doing what he was told that the producer had said, I'm never hiring this guy again. And his agent sent him up for this part, and the director, Daniel Petrie, who just died last year, saw him and thought, well, this guy is perfect. And then the producer said, well, no way, I'm not hiring him. And Daniel Petrie, who was also pretty hot at the time, said, you know, if you don't hire him, then I'm not going to do this. And so they acquiesced, and he got to cast Cassavetes, and that was really the part that launched him.
Yeah. Boy, pretty nervy to turn around and go right back and ask for another job.
Well, John always had a lot of nerve, and John liked nothing better than a good argument.
Yeah. Well, there's a story I think you tell in the book, and I'm, you know, there's so many great stories in the book, but he's done A Woman Under the Influence, and he's got to market it. And there was a critic that didn't care for his work, and he just walked right up to him, right? And just, you know, just took the bulls by the horns.
Are you talking about John Simon?
Maybe that's it. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah,
he went to a screening. John was friends with Jay Cox, who was the film critic for Time magazine at the time. And there were several critics who just never gave John his due. I mean, Pauline Kael was one, Vincent Canby, Stanley Kaufman. All were critics who just really felt that that he was overrated. But John Simon had been particularly vicious in his review. And John went to a screening with Jay Cox, and Jay pointed out John Simon, who was notorious for how acidic his writing could be, and went up to John Simon and says, hey, Jay Cox tells me you think I'm a complete idiot. And, you know, and was, you know, very good-natured about it. You know, he liked a good argument, and John Simon just, you know, totally backed down.
Yeah.
He also apparently one time was in a cab with Pauline Kael going to an after party and got into an argument with her and threw her shoes out the window of the taxi.
How refreshing.
And then I think carried her piggyback into the party.
Yeah. Is there a favorite John Cassavetes story for you? There's so many.
There's so many. One of my favorites is the one that Seymour Cassell told at the memorial for him, where the two of them were walking in somewhere in a bad neighborhood in Hollywood, and a mugger came out of the shadows with a gun and tried to rob them. And rather than just turn over his wallet, John started arguing with the guy, and pretty soon said, "Look, you know, don't do this. I tell you what, I'll give you a job on my movie. How about you? And then you come and work on the movie." And talked the guy out of robbing him, gave him a job, and according to Seymour Cassell, the guy went on in the business.
Mm-hmm. What should we know about his early life?
That his father was was Greek, came over to this country when he was about 10, you know, essentially by himself without his parents, worked his way up, worked his way through Harvard and became, you know, quite a scholar, was in a number of businesses and took the family back to Greece during the Depression when jobs dried up, and lived there from, I think, the time John was about 5 until he was 10, so that when John came back to the United States, he was behind in school, and he didn't speak English. He only spoke Greek, and he had to relearn English. And some people say that that was why he always had trouble reading and writing English, and so he ended up, all of his scripts he dictated to his secretary. He never wrote them down himself.
Yeah, and it sounds like his mother was quite a character.
His mother was a character, and she wound up being in several of his films. She's absolutely horrifying in Woman Under the Influence because she plays Peter Falk's mother, and she's a complete harridan in this film, and essentially convinces Peter Falk that he should commit his wife, who's played by Jenna Rollins, to a mental institution just because she's, you know, a little unconventional and a little, you know, sort of emotionally unstable, but certainly she's not someone that you would think would need to be committed, and yet the mother is so domineering and so loud about it that the husband gives in and betrays his wife and commits her to a mental institution.
Hmm. One of the things that Cassavetes said about that movie was that it was an exploration of the problems of women without really knowing what the answers are. Here again, we have a man in the moment. What else did he have to say about Woman Under the Influence?
Well, he wrote it because Jenna Rollins had said, you know, I mean, this was again the early 70s at the point when feminism was sort of just starting to blossom, and she said, you know, I'd really like to do something, you know, about women. And so he sat down and wrote a play and gave it to her, and she read it. She said, this is so emotionally devastating. There's no way I could do this play 8 times a week. And he said, okay, wait, I've got a better idea. And he goes off and comes back, you know, a few days later, and has written 2 more plays, so that he's written essentially a trilogy about this same character. And she says, you know, you don't understand. This doesn't make it easier. This just makes it harder. I mean, I'd be in a mental hospital if I had to perform these 3 plays over and over again. And it was at that point that he thought, all right, I will, and he distilled the 3 of them down into the script that became the movie, A Woman Under the Influence. But he didn't claim to have answers. He just felt that people were cruel to each other and kind to each other, sometimes without ever really knowing what they were doing, and really didn't understand themselves enough to know the effect they had on other people, and that love was such a powerful force that it could make you kind of crazy, or it could, you know, make you turn a blind eye to the person that you love the most.
Yeah. Speaking of love, Jenna Rollins had not planned on falling in love with anyone at the outset of her career. She really wanted to be an actress. But then along comes John Cassavetes. What happened?
She was a student at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, and she had grown up in Wisconsin, had traveled around the country. Her father had been in the oil business. He'd been a state senator in Wisconsin. He'd worked in Washington. And she knew she wanted to be an actress, but she also knew that being romantically involved with someone and getting married would derail her from that. And so she had made a vow to herself just not to get involved with anybody. And then she was backstage after being in a student production, and John was hanging out. He had already graduated, but he was hanging out with friends of his in the green room and spotted her across the room. And he said to a friend of his, "That's the girl I'm going to marry." And she took one look at him and knew he was trouble and thought, uh-oh, I'm not going to be able to live up to what it was I promised myself, which was not to get romantically involved with anyone.
How would you describe their marriage, their love for one another, and how did it affect their acting in the movies that they made?
Well, I think, I mean, it speaks for itself in that, you know, they were married in 1954 and they remained married until he died in 1989. And I think that he wrote roles for her and he challenged her in a way that no other director ever would have, who wasn't, you know, that intimately involved with her. I think he saw things in her that she didn't even see in herself, and wrote roles that, you know, I mean, no one else was writing those kinds of roles for anybody, and she was, there are people who think, well, you know, she limited her career by only acting in his films, but in fact, she had a career that she probably wouldn't have had because she got to play these great roles that he had written specifically for her.
Yeah. I think one of the things that sealed her love for John early in their relationship is that he talked to her. He talked with her. They had discussions. And I think that wasn't that critical?
Oh, yeah. I mean, she said that when they were on the set, they were, you know, actor and director. And, you know, and she could fight with him and she could argue with him. But then they'd come home and they would talk about the parts. I mean, even in the middle of the night, they'd wake up and have ideas and talk to each other. And it was a constant dialogue. And yet it was a dialogue about the material but not about the character, because he would never, ever talk to an actor about their character. He'd say, you know, I've written it, now it's yours, and you have to find this character, and you have to figure out who this character is. Don't ask me who, you know, what this character would do. You should know this because you are this character.
Yeah. You sought her approval for the book, and it took a while before you got it. Still, she didn't want to be interviewed, although she told anyone who asked they should talk to you.
Which was crucial. It really made all the difference in terms of getting access to people in the inner circle who did work with John, worked closely with him. He tended to work with the same people over and over again over the years, and stayed close with these people. It's like once you were on the team, you never got cut. But I actually approached her for the first time back in like 1992 after I'd written my Peckinpah book. I said, I was looking for a subject and felt like, I'm always interested in people who are sort of transitional figures who see an opening to a way to do something new and different and set off to do it, which Peckinpah did in terms of the interpretation of violence in the film, in films, and which Cassavetes did in terms of making personal independent films. And I got a very nice letter back from her saying, John never wanted a biography, and he made me promise not to talk to any biographers, but I wish you luck with your project. And having just finished this book with about Peckinpah, where I did have the family's cooperation, and knowing how hard it had been even with that, mm-hmm. I thought, boy, there's no way I'm going to jump into another project here where I don't have the approval of the family. So I put it on the back burner, and it was about a dozen years later I sort of had the idea again and approached her again, and she said, well, you know, I still feel the same way. John made me promise. She says, but I read your Peckinpah book and I liked it. And so, you know, if I'll give you my approval and I'll tell anybody who asks me that, yes, they should talk to you.
Okay, so it was the Peckinpah book that led her to meet you halfway, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, she never spoke to me for the book. We did meet and had lunch in the fall of 2004 at the point where I was just about to start writing, had mostly completed my research. And she told me a few stories over lunch, but I was trying to convince her that she should sit down and talk to me. I wanted to talk to her about her childhood, about her life at the Academy, and what it was like to work on Broadway and in television in the 50s, just to get more of a flavor of that. And felt like I almost had her convinced, but then had a call a couple of days later from the fellow who sort of acted as our go-between, saying, no, Jenna changed her mind, and she just isn't comfortable talking. Mm. So, you know, I respect that, and just am so grateful that she gave me her approval in the first place.
Yeah. Has she read the book? Do you know?
She has the book. She said she probably won't read the book.
Oh.
I think it's still too painful.
Yeah. Speaking of, you mentioned she told you a couple of stories about her childhood. There's a great story about her father's reaction when she told her parents, I want to go to New York and become an actress.
And he said, well, you know, whatever makes you happy. If you want to train elephants, that's fine.
Yeah, that's great. And she also said of her mother, she was a feminist, dad was a chauvinist, and they got along famously.
Well, yeah, it's an interesting combination. And I think that I wish I'd been able to find out more about her family, but it sounds like she had a really sort of interesting, sort of liberal upbringing, given that she grew up mostly in Wisconsin, which tended to be sort of a liberal state.
Yeah. What led her to her interest in acting?
I think she was just discovered it in college, did some acting in high, did a little bit of acting in high school, but was, I guess, not encouraged by her teachers or the drama coaches there. but then rediscovered it when she was at the University of Wisconsin, to the point where she told her family, you know, I want to be an actress, and this isn't the place to do it, and I've heard about this place, the Academy, the American Academy of Dramatic Arts in New York, and I want to go do that. And luckily for her, they said, go ahead.
Mm. What was the reaction of Cassavetes' parents, Nicholas and Catherine, when he told them he wanted to be an actor?
Well, I mean, his mother was ready to throw up her hands with him because he had dropped out of school. His older brother was an achiever, had been in the Army, had graduated from college, I believe was either working on Wall Street or was an accountant, I forget. But John was, you know, sort of the class clown, the one that, you know, nobody had much expectations of. He was not a student and really sort of was rootless and didn't know what he wanted to do. And so when he hit on acting, you know, his mother just, you know, threw up her hands in exasperation, but his father said, you know, well, you know, this is a very serious thing. You're going to be portraying the human condition, you know, for other people, and so you need to take it seriously. But, you know, he supported him, and I believe that he told him that he would pay for the second semester, but John had to earn the money for the first semester.
Mm. This was a surprise to me. Not that he studied with Lee Strasberg briefly, but that he hated it. Did that surprise you?
No, because, I mean, John was just, you know, hated anything that was too doctrinaire.
Hmm.
My impression of the studio at that time was that it was pretty doctrinaire, that it was, you know, Lee's way or the highway.
Hmm.
Plus he hated the exclusionary quality of it, that it was, you know, they were hand-picking people, and I believe he was turned down initially and was only invited to join at the point where he'd had success in television. And so he went and prepared supposedly prepared an audition piece and told them what the name of it was, and he went in with his friend Burton Lane. And in fact, they were just making it up as they went along, and afterwards the teachers were all going, this is wonderful, it's, you know, this is terrific, we want you to study here. And he said, well, you know, you've just been had because we just made this all up, this was all totally improvised, and I've got my own acting school and I'm going to put you out of business.
Ooh.
I don't believe that he ever did, but he had that kind of confidence.
Yeah. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, biographer and critic Marshall Fine. His latest book is a biography of John Cassavetes, Accidental Genius, How John Cassavetes Invented the American Independent Film. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, we have a few minutes remaining in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, give us a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. John Cassavetes was a heavy drinker, and it was cirrhosis of the liver that took his life in 1989. How did he, at the time of his death, look back on his life and his career in film?
Well, I think that he was, I think that like any of us, he wished he had more time. The drinking itself it never seemed to be an issue. I mean, everybody that I talked to said, you know, I always saw John drinking, but I never saw John drunk. He never seemed impaired. He never slurred his words or stumbled around. It always just sort of seemed to fuel him. And he said to Peter Bogdanovich at one point that was his problem, was that he never got drunk. He drank a lot, but never got drunk, and so never thought it was a problem. And it was only in 1983 he was diagnosed with cirrhosis, and in fact they said that he only had about a year to live. And in fact he lived for another 6 years. He quit drinking. He quit smoking. He tried to eat more healthily. But, you know, I think that there was a certain amount of regret that this was what was killing him, and that there was no, in his mind, no recourse. I mean, this was a time when liver transplants had pretty much been perfected, but he had a distrust of doctors and just said, you know, if I ever go into the hospital, I'll never come out. And so that was not an option.
Yeah. Did he have a favorite film? Did he have a favorite that he made? And did he have a favorite acting role?
I think that he always really liked The Dirty Dozen. As I said, he really enjoyed working for Robert Aldrich. I think among his other films, I think that he loved them all, that he just, you know, that each one was a unique experience to him, that they all represented an expression of something that he had a passion for, and that he was proud that he had gotten them made. I mean, I feel like that's what makes him such an icon of independent film that he was able to remain true to this vision and never sort of sold out, never took any of his success and used it to launch himself into the mainstream. He always wanted to keep working on his own. And I feel like that's the difference between him and many of the people who start out as independent filmmakers today. To them, it's a stepping stone to working at a studio and making a sequel or making a remake, that they've got that one film in them that they believe passionately about and that's their vision and they just want to get it made. But John was constantly fighting that battle of people telling him, well, nobody wants to see this, or, you know, you're crazy to make this movie, or you'll never get this done. And to me, that's, you know, that's what independent film is about, is the people who make those movies that they have to make, not that they feel like other people want to see, but that they have to get out and rip out of their soul and put on the screen for other people to see.
Yeah. At the end of the first chapter, you say he didn't care for what was the fashion of the moment. You say he wanted people to see his films, but he wasn't willing to compromise by making those films audience friendly. And on at least one occasion, you say he recut a finished film because he thought it was audience friendly.
Oh yeah, he made the film Husbands. After he did Faces, there was enough. It made enough money that there was interest from other financiers. He found an Italian financier to put up the money, and he sold the rights to Columbia before he'd finished it. So he had enough money to finish the film, and shot it and cut it and showed it to a preview audience, and it killed. People were laughing. People loved it. It had got this great response, and he just came out shaking his head and said, you know, it's too easy on them. This isn't the movie that I wanted to make. It's too easy on them. And he spent another, and it was supposed to come out. There'd been a big spread on the cover of Life magazine, and it was supposed to come out within, you know, the next couple of months, and instead he spent the next year recutting it, much to the chagrin of Columbia Pictures, making it into a much darker, tougher movie that was not nearly as successful as a lot of people think that original version might have been.
Is there another filmmaker that's done that?
No, I mean, you always hear about them. You know,
right, they make it happy.
They make it happier, they go for the happy ending, or they spend more time, you know, cutting it down, but not many who insist on making it harder, tougher on the audience.
Hmm. What was your introduction to the films of John Cassavetes?
Well, I remember him as an actor when I was a teenager, seeing him in The Dirty Dozen and seeing him in Rosemary's Baby, but I was a freshman in college at the University of Minnesota when Faces came out and read about it. It sounded intriguing, and I went and saw it, and it just knocked me out. It was unlike any movie I'd ever seen, and really, to this day, there's not another movie I can think of that has that quality of emotional rawness that Faces has, and it just sort of opened my eyes to a different way that films could be, and so I started paying attention when his films would come out. I mean, I was still in college when Husbands came out, and Minnie and Moskowitz, and had sort of started as a film critic by the time Woman Under the Influence came out. But, you know, just always was fascinated by his films and just how different they were from anything else that was being made.
Mm. For folks listening this afternoon, and for myself, now going back, taking a look again at the films of John Cassavetes, where do you think we should start? Faces?
I'd say Faces or A Woman Under the Influence. I mean, they're still very tough films. I mean, you look at them, and nobody had made anything like them before that, and really nobody's done anything like it since. And they have a power that will surprise people. Both of those films are very good. I think Husbands is hard to find because it's sort of out of print, although it shows up on television from time to time. I like Minnie and Moskowitz, and Shadows. I mean, they put out a box set in 2004, Criterion Collection did, called Five by Cassavetes, that had Shadows, Faces, A Woman Under the Influence, Killing of a Chinese Bookie, and Opening Night, which are all the films that he made with his own money and which he owned. And they've been cleaned up, and they're gorgeous versions, and really that's the place to start.
Okay, well, I will start there this weekend.
Well, you'll be surprised at the impact that they'll have on you.
Yeah. Marshall Fine, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon.
My pleasure, Celeste. Thanks for having me on.
Marshall Fine, biographer and critic, has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is Accidental Genius, How John Cassavetes Invented the American Independent Film. The book is published by Miramax. He is also the author of biographies of Sam Peckinpah and Harvey Keitel, and I believe the Sam Peckinpah biography now just out in a paperback edition. Marshall Fine, latest book, Accidental Genius.